From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with the executive director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce about how they plan to use federal aid dollars. Then we'll learn how a proposed sandhill crane hunt could have an impact beyond the bird's population levels.
They're an iconic species that many people associate with their best experiences outdoors. And we need to be very careful to protect people's ability to have that experience and to protect the crane population itself.
A paranormal researcher goes over some of Wisconsin's most notable UFO sightings and activity.
Well, I'm amazed by how it seems to affect the entire spectrum of the state, from rural areas to urban areas to men, women, true believers, diehard skeptics.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with this. Earlier this month, Governor Tony Evers announced $75 million in grants will be allocated for businesses in underserved communities. This funding from the American Rescue Plan Act is meant to help those communities rebound from the economic hardships caused by the pandemic. Of this money, approximately $37.5 million will go to small businesses through community development funds, and the other portion will go to chambers of commerce for underserved communities. Businesses owned by people of color have struggled throughout the pandemic. Some did not qualify for federal loans, and the pandemic has amplified the inequities in business creation. Chambers of commerce have long served as resources for making businesses' dreams come true in an inequitable system. Mai C. Herr is the executive director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Thank you so much, Mai C., for being here on Lake Effect. Tell me a little bit about how the pandemic has affected businesses within your chamber. What has the landscape looked like?
Well, first of all, I'll say this. Many of the folks that we tend to work with, they come from historically underinvested, underbanked individuals. And so what that typically means is they don't have a strong relationship with many traditional financial institutions. And their margins for any sort of funds that they might have available are very small. So when there is something like a pandemic that hits, it hits really hard. And then, of course, you know, it was really, they were really impacted not only by the pandemic, but of course, everything was compounded by some of the racial tensions, some of the racial incidences that occurred in our different communities throughout around the world, really.
What is the importance of chambers of commerce within communities of color, within underserved communities?
So, Mallory, let me just go ahead and say a little bit about my own background. That'll provide you some context. You know, I'm a daughter of an entrepreneur. I'm Hmong American, grew up in central Wisconsin. My father could have used a place like the services that we provide here at the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. You know, he went to a bank and he received some support, but he also knew of others and himself included that they didn't really receive, you know, as much support as they would have liked. And therefore their relationships, as I mentioned earlier, weren't quite as strong with financial institutions compared to, you know, perhaps their white counterparts in the community. And eventually to the point where many decided they wanted to band together and to pool funds so they can make funds available. They created their own financial to create funding for those who might need it in the community. So, you know, they did that. Now, who would have thought years later, I would be sitting here in a position at an office that could have been very helpful to someone like my father. So having said that, because of individuals like my father, there's many of them still out there. That's why we're here. The $75 million, about half of that is really for many of our ethnic diverse chambers who work with some of these communities underrepresented, underinvested, underbanked, so that we, our chambers, could broaden our capacity to be able to help them. Because a lot of our chambers are working, our ethnic chambers, ethnic diverse chambers, are working on shoestring budgets. We do it well, but we could certainly do it even better. And we want to be able to reach even more people.
And it sounds like, too, your chambers work as a different route or pathway for business owners who can't go down the traditional pathways of going to the bank or getting a loan right away because of whatever factors there might be. In what ways will this government funding help those businesses or future businesses impacted?
So half of the $75 million, like I said, it will be more directly impacting supporting us, you know, in our chambers so that we can perhaps hire more people. We can keep our lights on, you know, help us pay our rent, you know, whatever that might be, or mortgage if we have that. And so that in itself means more TA, more technical assistance, more support for business owners who need it and us getting to them faster. The other $37.5 million is for those of us who do lending, HWCC included, and I believe, of course, other ethnic chambers, other in this community. So those dollars are going to allow us to keep a pool of funds for lending purposes. Some of the specifics of how these dollars could be used are still being worked out. We actually are still waiting for the application to come out because we still have to do work too. So even though these dollars have pretty much been earmarked, you could say, we still have to apply for them just like anything else. We still have to provide reasons for these dollars before they'll be given to us.
I see. Tell me a little bit about what the work in the chamber has looked like throughout the pandemic. What has the day-to-day look like?
So, and I can't speak for everybody's chambers, but I would say us at the Mullen Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, we provide technical assistance, networking opportunities, resources, connections, if we need to do that for clients and other members who come to us. But we also provide lending dollars for those who qualify. At our particular chamber, we can give anywhere between $1,000 to $75,000 to someone who might qualify and need those funds to support their business. Most of the clients, members that come to us are, you know, startup businesses, those who are starting up new businesses, new entrepreneurs. Something else about these individuals are ones that, as I mentioned before, maybe they haven't received the full support that they could have or should have received from a traditional bank. But also some of them, and sometimes it's connected, are considered high risk by a traditional bank. So what we do is, you know, they might come to us, but we use a broader, I'll say, source of measure to determine whether or not they qualify. You know, do they have, for example, do they have experience in this field? You know, do they have other sources of collateral? And so it's not just based on, for example, a credit score. You know, so we'll look at all of those different factors. You know, how does their borrowing history look like? What's their character? Does it seem like they have it, you know, in them to be able to be successful and repay back, for example, loan? And some people might say, Mallory, why loans? Why not just give them grants? Because we know that some of the most wealthy or independent business owners are those who know how to use lending dollars. You know, so we want to be able to, for example, through technical support, provide them the resources they need, walk them through that if they need that, so that they can be successful like others as well.
How will your chambers be using this funding? How do you envision it being used?
We will certainly be expanding the number of staff we have around the state, because our office, we serve statewide. And so we're a community development financial institution. So the mission in itself is really to do all the things we just mentioned to you, and more specifically, concentrate on the historically underserved communities. Having said that, also, we don't turn anyone away in terms of providing resources, you know, like support. Lending dollars are a different story. There's certain criteria. It has to be from certain populations or their businesses held in a particular area. And then, of course, the other half is really expanding our pool of lending dollars, providing perhaps like QuickBooks programs, you know, or training that might be made available to our members who may need it. I think the opportunities are endless, but we would need to see the application first before we can make any final decisions.
And this, of course, is the first step of combating and dealing with a larger issue of inequity and inequality within business ownership. From your perspective, what is needed in the long term to sustain and support small businesses from underserved communities in the state?
I think that we need continual following up with these businesses, providing them opportunities to receive training. I think we need to be going to them and saying, what do you need? You know, how can we serve you in those ways? And I'm listening to the folks, the businesses that tend to come to us. They're micro businesses. They're small businesses, really small, you know, solopreneurs. Some of their needs are different from some of the other small businesses that are much larger. One of the other topics I should say that I'm starting to hear from small business owners is, how do I invest? You know, how do I begin investing in commercial real estate? How do I continue to grow my wealth in some way? So they're having different types of conversations too. People are different places in their business mindset and development. So we're listening to them. And I would also say providing different information in different languages if that is necessary. So we do that. That's very important that we have staff on hand that can speak, for example, both Hmong and English. In many instances, although we don't just serve the Hmong community. So while the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, you know, originally started because of, you know, many Hmong individuals who felt the need to create something like this, our focus now is really, now we've been around for about 20 years, is really to broaden it to the AAPI community. That's our target community, business community. However, we do have programs in-house, within the HWCC, where we're working with other underserved communities as well. Our portfolio is actually quite diverse. It's really, you know, it spans the different racial groups. As I mentioned earlier, the margin of error for many of these businesses is really small. Many of our ethnic diverse businesses were some of the most hardest hit by the pandemic. And again, because it was compounded, you know, by some of the racial tensions and incidences around the world. And these dollars are going to help not only us, but help them to be able to not only survive, but thrive and then sustain beyond that. And we're just thrilled to be able to have that opportunity to be a part of that story.
Thank you so much, Maisy, for speaking with me today on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mallory.
Maisy Herr is the executive director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. There's a bill moving through the Wisconsin legislature that would create a hunting season for the sandhill crane. The long-necked migrator with a haunting call is currently protected in Wisconsin, but a Republican-authored bill could change that. Not everyone is thrilled about the crane's rebounding population, especially farmers who grow corn, which cranes eat. Last week, there was testimony in front of the Senate Committee on Sporting Heritage, Small Business, and Rural Issues. Wisconsin's Greenfire is one group that testified. The nonprofit advocates for science-based natural resource management and is made up of many retired Wisconsin DNR scientists and specialists. Executive Director Fred Clark explains why the group did not take a formal position on the proposal, but instead asked legislators to consider a series of factors before authorizing the sandhill crane hunting season.
Cranes are somewhat unique among migratory bird populations in that they're very long-lived species, and they have a slow reproductive cycle. And many cranes don't even begin breeding until they're 4 or 5 years of age, for example. And even then, their reproductive rate is relatively low. That means that hunting can quickly reduce a crane population to levels that could become unsustainable. And that's a consideration for a unique species like cranes. We also wanted to convey that one of the major concerns of agricultural producers is the depredation or the basically damage done to planted crop fields in the spring, primarily corn, as a result of cranes who are moving through these areas in the spring and eating the seed. That's a major concern for growers, as it should be. But the proposal for fall hunting of cranes will have almost no ability to have an impact on reducing agricultural damage from cranes that feed in spring. hunting cranes in the fall to stop spring feeding is like stopping a car for speeding on the interstate highway on Friday because somebody was speeding on Wednesday. These are different birds. And so in our assessment, there's no sustainable level of hunting that will have a significant reduction in agricultural damage from cranes. And if our goal, which is it should be, is to reduce the impact cranes have on farmers, what we need to do are find solutions that will be targeted to that problem. And that can include seed treatment to make corn undesirable to cranes, which we know is effective. That will also require the ability to help compensate farmers for lost production, and in some cases to help fund the additional cost of seed treatment so that it can be used more widely.
Have there been cases in which Green Fire has said, wait, hold everything to the state legislature, a wildlife management measure that's being considered is not healthy, would not be healthy? Or do you generally do what you did here and say, we're not saying don't do it, do it, but please consider these points?
We always base our decision of whether to either oppose or support or remain neutral on legislation based on our having some science-based information that we can bring to that discussion. So we do also choose to support or oppose legislation when we think that's clearly appropriate. We opposed the February wolf hunt, which was not legislation, but was a court-ordered department action, because we felt really clearly that holding a hunt on that extremely short notice was going to create messy, unintended consequences right in the heart of the wolf breeding season. And unfortunately, that concern proved to be true. In the case of the crane hunt proposal, it can be argued that the crane population is robust enough to support a recreational hunt. And from a strict population standpoint, that's correct. However, we just wanted to be very clear that that's not the only consideration. Agricultural damage from cranes will not be solved by having a recreational crane hunt. Likewise, we wanted to make the case that the value that the public places on cranes is generally very high. Wisconsin and out-of-state visitors spend millions of dollars every year on wildlife viewing and activities associated with that, including food, travel, and lodging. It's a significant investment in our economy that comes from people who value cranes for what they are. So our position is that anyone considering a crane hunt needs to carefully weigh the multiple other benefits that crane provide, both spiritual values, cultural values, as well as the tourism-related values that cranes provide in Wisconsin in one of the core breeding grounds of this central population.
And also, I think many people know the eastern population was nearly extirpated. I mean, it was long ago, the 19th and early 20th centuries. So this being another case of that population being restored and being much more robust. So that should give lawmakers and wildlife managers pause.
It absolutely should. You know, the remarkable recovery of cranes came as a result of protection from hunting and crane's ability, the sandhill crane ability in particular, to adapt to kind of a varied habitat that includes both, you know, wetlands and marshes as well as agricultural lands. And as you know, many parts of Wisconsin provide that type of habitat abundantly. But that recovery is, it's really important for us not to lose sight of the fact that this is a population that depends on conservation practices and will not tolerate a high level of removal from hunting. And both because of risks to the population from overhunting and public pushback that could occur if a hunting program is too aggressive, there are a lot of risks of implementing a hunting program that need to be carefully considered.
So I've read some feel that Governor Evers and the DNR haven't listened to what the outdoors men and women of the state want and need. What's your take on that, Fred?
Well, we have a long tradition in Wisconsin of developing policies and legislation around fish and wildlife based on the input that comes from the ground up through our Conservation Congress, and that also comes through the many different sporting organizations in this state that promote conservation for fish and wildlife. So when the legislative package came out that hadn't originated through any of those groups, and for which most of those groups were simply unaware, that took a lot of people in the conservation community by surprise.
So as you said earlier, this is certainly seems to be a species that means a lot to a lot of people, whether they are the hikers and the bikers or people who do hunt and fish. So it's a balance here.
It absolutely is. Cranes have a very high social tolerance and, in fact, social acceptance and appreciation in Wisconsin. They're an iconic species that many people associate with their best experiences outdoors. And we need to be very careful to protect people's ability to have that experience and to protect the crane population itself.
And then it takes us back too, Fred, to the fact that biodiversity and trying to maintain a balanced ecosystem that impacts everything from water to air and in between, this would factor into that, I would think.
It absolutely does. The reason we're fortunate enough to see a recovering crane population is because of the successes in both protection of the species from hunting and in the habitat protection and restoration that's, you know, provided places for cranes to live and breed. And those are some of the most important investments we make in conservation in this state that benefit many other species.
So speaking of species, are there other wildlife issues that Greenfire has on its collective mind that's top of all of your lists?
Oh, well, you know, the hot button issues keep coming up, of course, the wolves and the cranes and deer, perennial topics of controversy and conversation. But it would be wise for us to pay attention to other species that aren't always on the headlines every day. Songbirds. Long-term decline in populations of breeding songbirds should be a concern for everyone who cares about wildlife. Most people don't think of insects as wildlife, but the population of pollinators in our state and the population of bees and other insects that pollinate both plants and wildflowers and crops is another part of our biodiversity and our biotic heritage that all of us should be concerned about. And the decline in pollinator populations is something that will affect all of us ultimately if we don't reverse those declines.
So, Fred, you just came off a series of socials in different parts of the state, six different areas, right? Did cranes come up? Did wolves come up? What are some of the key things that you were hearing from people throughout the state when it comes to wildlife?
Sure. We held outdoor conservation social events in six communities all around Wisconsin, from Milwaukee to Washburn, in the last 6 weeks. And yes, cranes came up, wolves came up, clean water comes up, climate change comes up. But I would say the one topic that came up consistently that maybe cuts across all those issues are people's concern that our tradition of conservation governance in this state is being threatened. And we're in uncharted territory today with this continuing controversy and escalating controversy with the role of the Natural Resources Board and the DNR and almost every issue being litigated in courts. I think a lot of people with many different opinions about specific wildlife or conservation issues are concerned that our traditions of solving these issues civilly and in a way that's constructive and is ultimately sustainable is threatened and will make it impossible for us to manage natural resources the way we have in the last 100 years. Everyone's concerned about that future.
Fred Clark is the executive director of Wisconsin's Green Fire. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz about the proposed sandhill crane hunting season. The legislation is now up for a full Senate vote. Coming up in about 12 minutes, our Dig In series will explore some fall reading to get you excited for spring planting. But first, we look to the sky and talk about UFO sightings in Wisconsin with paranormal researcher Chad Lewis.
In 1896 and 1897, the U.S. had the largest UFO flap in America's history. Thousands of people in hundreds of Midwestern cities saw these giant airships, as they were called. And the people of Milwaukee were no different.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Whether you want to believe or not, Wisconsin has a history of UFO sightings and odd occurrences. In fact, we rank 21st in the country for most reported UFO sightings. While we do get a lot of reports, it could be because so many investigators are collecting them, or perhaps Wisconsinites are more comfortable reporting sightings, according to paranormal researcher and author Chad Lewis. He was featured in an article about UFOs in Wisconsin for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me now to share what stands out to him when researching UFO sightings in the state.
Well, I'm amazed by how it seems to affect the entire spectrum of the state, from rural areas to urban areas to men, women, true believers, diehard skeptics, people who are out looking for it, people who are minding their own business. So there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to why some people are seeing these things and others are not, but it runs the entire board of people experiencing something they just can't identify.
You mentioned people might feel more willing or comfortable to report things here in Wisconsin. What is the process of reporting? You know, what do you look for to consider it a, quote, report of a sighting or something strange happening?
Well, people will go about it in a couple ways. One, they might just report it online where they can remain anonymous, and they feel like they get it out there in case anyone else had seen it or can look back upon it. And those are in national and state databases for UFO reporting. But then other people will contact researchers, and they are looking for a little more in-depth investigation, wondering if others had seen what they had seen, wondering if there was a flap in the area or any other explanation that might be going on, especially when it incorporates all kinds of other weirdness with possible beings on board these craft or missing time or oddities of that nature.
So there are a few documented sightings in the Milwaukee area throughout history. So let's begin with the sighting of 1896. Can you explain what happened then?
In 1896 and 1897, the U.S. had the largest UFO flap in America's history. Thousands of people in hundreds of Midwestern cities saw these giant airships, as they were called. And the people of Milwaukee were no different. They spotted it from downtown up in the sky, floating at speeds that they weren't used to seeing of if it were a kite or some man-made vessel of some inventor out there. So people were watching in disbelief. And then they would follow it in their newspaper as this airship moved from city to city. You could follow its path in all the newspapers that covered it. But by all accounts, it was large, it was quick moving, and it was something that was unknown. It wasn't as though, again, somebody's flying a kite or a misidentification of a star or a planet or an embellishment or a hoax. There was something there, but what it was, nobody could agree upon it.
There's also another kind of slew of sightings that seemed to come in waves in 1947. Firstly, there was a sighting of 9 saucer-shaped objects over Mount Rainier in Washington state. But how did that sighting in Washington then influence the modern concept of UFOs for people around the country and here in Wisconsin?
Well, Kenneth Arnold's sighting really set the UFO field on fire. One, we got the term flying saucer from it, but also here was this credible, trained observer, a pilot, talking about what he saw in technical terms, scientific terms of speed, distance, his estimates. And I think it gave the general public a wide belief that maybe there's something to this. And of course, researchers will consider this confirmation bias, that when people hear of all UFOs in the sky, they're likely to see anything in the sky as being a UFO. But I also take it the flip side of it, that when people hear of these sightings, they keep an eye out, they pay more attention. And normally these things might have just passed by them. But since they're giving it so much more attention because it's on their mind, we get more sightings. So I don't necessarily think it's confirmation bias. I think it could be just an awareness of things happening, and it makes people pay more attention. But it certainly, I think, put into the public consciousness that there are things out there that are really weird.
Well, in the 1947 sightings, especially over the summer, was, I guess, frequent enough and taken seriously enough that Wisconsin Civil Air Patrol conducted nightly sweeps of the skies. Like, has any measure like this occurred since, or was that the first time a measure like that was taken? And was that the only time, or are there other periods where these things were especially taken note of that involved, you know, government bodies actually getting involved?
Up in Lake Superior in the 1960s and 70s, jets from a nearby airbase were scrambled into the sky to chase after UFOs that were spotted over the lake. And it makes sense that if these things truly are unidentified flying objects or unidentified aerial phenomena, you would think that the defense would like to know what they are, whether they're hoaxes or competing countries with their technology or something not of this world. Investigating it, I don't think gives it credibility. And I think a lot of the government departments are afraid of that, that if they look into it like they did with Project Blue Book and other research components, that they automatically give it credibility. When in fact, I think most people would say you should be looking into it to decide what's real and what's not.
There's also a 1961 case. There was an Eagle River farmer that claimed not just a UFO sighting, but an alien interaction. Can you explain what happened then?
This may be one of the weirdest encounters you'll ever hear about. And it happened to Joe Simonton, a part-time plumber and chicken farmer in Eagle River in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. And he was having a late breakfast one day when he sees a craft descend into his yard and hover there. And Simonton had never given much thought to UFOs, so much to his credit, he went out to interact with it. And when he got there, an opening appeared on the craft, and one of the inhabitants, the pilot, the alien, the man, whatever it was, came to the front, and Simonton could see a couple other identical-looking creatures or people inside. And Simonton described them as all being very small, dark-haired, dark-eyed, dark-skinned. He thought they reminded him of small Italian men. As weird as that sounds, one of them had a jug, and without any verbal communication, Simonton realized they needed water. So he went to his house, filled the jug up with water, and came back and handed it to the leader, the presumed leader. And when he looked inside, he saw one of these things was cooking something over a flameless type grill. And he was trying to get some communication going. So he kind of motioned, "Are you going to eat that?" And the leader went over and grabbed several of these and traded Simonton for the water, what the media was calling these alien pancakes, these saucer cakes. And Simonton ate one of these pancakes and said it was the worst tasting pancake he'd ever had. He said, "No wonder they're so small. This is what they're eating." And then the craft closed up, flew off out of Simonton's sight. And once he reported it, people descended on his farm, thousands of people looking for those alien pancakes. And it aroused the attention of Project Blue Book and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who came up from Illinois to interview Simonton to see what was going on. And they even had the pancakes analyzed.
You mentioned people flocking to these sites right after it's reported. There's also sightings in the 1970s in Elmwood, Wisconsin. There's also towns of Belleville and Dundee that all get put on the UFO map, so to speak. So how did modern sightings like this put a spot onto tourism or of true believers? How would you classify this kind of tourism?
It certainly is supernatural tourism, and it's something that has really grown in the last couple decades. When I was first doing a book in the early 2000s about haunted places, no matter where I was, people would say, whether it was a theater, bed and breakfast, hotel, whatever it was, they'd say, we don't want to be in your book because if people find out we're haunted, nobody's going to come here. And then they said, go ahead, who's going to read that book anyway? And now I get emails from them saying, thanks so much for putting us in the book. So I think people love the uniqueness of it, that when you can go to any big city and see the same hotels, the same restaurants, the same businesses, that uniqueness of having Elmwood as being a spot where UFOs are sighted, you're not going to get that anywhere else. So I think people are craving that uniqueness and that fun of things in their own backyard.
Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher and author of several books, including The Wisconsin Road Guide to Mysterious Creatures. He was featured in a Milwaukee Magazine article about UFO sightings in Wisconsin this month, and you can find more information about it at WUWM.com. Coming up in this month's Dig In, Venus Williams explains why it's important to thank your garden before putting it to bed for the winter.
It's one of those things that more people are doing, especially as we continue to live into this pandemic, and we talk about scarcity of food and scarcity of goods, and yet our gardens were so abundant.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's that time of year again. Winter is coming to Wisconsin. As we prepare our bodies and minds for the impending deep freeze, it's also a time to prepare our yards and gardens while remembering the bounty they've already given us. Every month, Lake Effect's Joy Powers is joined by Venus Williams, the executive director of Alice's Garden, for our series called Dig In, which is all about gardening and healthy cooking. This month, they explore how to put your garden to bed and fall reading that will help you get excited for spring.
So we're finally getting into perhaps Wisconsin's most infamous season, winter. What should we be doing in our gardens before winter really sets in?
This time of year is really one of my most favorite for the garden because I love putting gardens to bed. I like the beauty of autumn, but also what autumn calls us to pay attention to in our gardens. For me, putting the garden to bed always begins with a ritual of gratitude, whether that is literally going around and blessing each and every one of my plots and fields and thanking them for all that they have provided throughout the growing season. It is one of those things that more people are doing, especially as we continue to live into this pandemic, and we talk about scarcity of food and scarcity of goods, and yet our gardens were so abundant. So I always encourage people to start with that ritual of gratitude for your gardens. And then after you thank your gardens, make sure you harvest what remains. A lot of people stop harvesting because of the abundance, and we get tired of the tomatoes and tired of all that remains. Don't. Go ahead and take the time and pick all that remains from your gardens, and then you can begin to clean and to cut back. I really want to make sure that when we talk about cutting back our gardens, that we don't start that too soon. I often hear from people who want to know particularly about their lavender come spring and summer, and why their lavender has not done well. And then I ask them, did you cut your lavender way back in the fall? And the answer is normally yes. So there are some things that you want to focus on cutting back right now, and some things that you don't. The things you do, the perennials that you do want to prune during this time of year, of course, are the irises, begonias, clematis, the daylilies. Still a good time to even divide some of those things and transplant them. The things you don't want to prune and cut back are the asters, lavender, as we already talked about, lamb's ear, hostas. You could wait until the frost to do those also, but I really recommend that you wait until spring to cut those plants back. So again, if you're pruning, wait until after the first frost. The reason why that's so important is, as we have seen during this October, we've had some incredible, beautiful, warm days. If you cut back too soon, you're encouraging growth, and you don't want your plants to start growing again. So wait until after the frost to cut back your perennial plants.
With that same idea of protecting our plants as we're moving into a colder season where, you know, it can be a little damaging to some kinds of plants, what are the ways in which we can make sure that things we've put in the ground this autumn or things that we are hoping to appear in spring are still protected?
Yes, there's a delicate balance also of wanting to provide some food for our animal friends throughout the winter, but there are some things we don't want them to feast upon. So you can always put some fencing around some of your shrubs and to guard trees, especially for those folks who live where there are a lot of deer. Rabbits are still active in the next few months. And so you could put up some fencing to protect them. Of course, there are those cones that we see. So you want to put the cones on your roses. I also put cones sometimes over a few of my perennials and even some of my annuals. Because if it is a really mild winter, some of those annuals will start all over again. You can cut them back come spring. So one of the examples is my pineapple sage. I grow lots of pineapple sage. It's one of my favorite herbs. I will put cones over at least six of those plants, and sometimes they will act like they are perennial, like they do not know. The same could be true for rosemary. Some rosemary plants and varieties may want to come back if the winter is mild. So don't be afraid to also protect your favorite annuals, especially those herbs that might be able to overwinter. Kale and collard greens, they really like cool temperatures. And sometimes you can put cones or some plastic, some hoop house varieties over your kale and your collards and some of your other greens. So it's a matter of extending the season, but it is also protecting and getting a jump start for spring.
Sure. Now, as we're looking at harvesting things from our garden still, and things that we may have already harvested and saved for the winter or for this autumn, what are some great recipes that really speak to this season?
One of the books that I want to recommend during this time together today is The Book of Greens. It's by a woman named Jen Lewis, the Lewis spelled L-O-U-I-S. And it is an incredible book of recipes and history on greens. She doesn't just focus on what may be familiar. She includes forage greens and succulents, herbs, things like seaweed. There are some familiar greens in her recipes, but there are also some unfamiliar greens, some of which I cannot even pronounce. One of my favorite, very simple recipes in this book is pickled chard stems. So everyone knows if you're growing Swiss chard right now, there's so much of it. And sometimes the stems are great for sauteing, and sometimes they can be a little tough, but we often have a lot of it. Pickled chard stems is one of my favorite recipes within this book. But again, we're also looking at the bounty of greens, and we're still planting some of our greens. This is a great time to plant spinach still and some lettuce this October, early November time. Some of those will germinate right now, and some will not germinate until next spring. So you get that jump start on the garden. But what's probably most important right now as we talk about what we should do to put our gardens to bed is that cleaning out and prepping the soil and feeding the soil. So I talked about thanking my beds. One of the ways that I thank my garden beds is to feed them, to nourish them, so that that soil also has what it needs to grow and be nourished over the winter. What we will do at Alice's Garden Urban Farm over the next couple of weeks are the apples that have fallen from the trees that we didn't get to in time. We will actually give them as a gift to the soil and work them into the soil, composting them directly there. Another thing that people don't think about when it comes to putting the garden to bed is your garden tools. You also want to care for your garden tools as you put your garden to bed. It's easy to go ahead and put them away with the soil on them and with not cleaning them, but go ahead and rinse off your garden tools, sharpen them if you are able to do that, but most importantly, oil them. There are some basic oils, some of the same oils that you use on the rest of your equipment, but I like to use even natural oils. So some olive oil, mineral oil, the same things that I would use to oil my knives in my kitchen, I use this time of year to care for my garden tools.
And I'm sure we'll all be thankful for doing these kinds of things when we get to the spring. I know there have been many times when I went, why couldn't I just take the moment to clean off the dirt?
Indeed. And we don't think about the rusting and the damage that can happen to our tools throughout the winter if we don't care for them properly.
Now, there was one other book that you wanted to highlight this month as we're kind of celebrating autumn here and getting into winter.
Vegetable Literacy is the book. It's by a woman named Deborah Madison. And it is one of those books that you will take to bed with you. The gift of October, November, December is if you're a true hardcore gardener, we're already planning for the next season. What I love about Vegetable Literacy is once again, it helps me to appreciate the abundance and the variety of what we can grow throughout the world. But it also introduces me to new vegetables. It provides a history of the vegetables. It also provides some recipes. But more importantly, when I take it to bed with me, I make that list from both the Book of Greens and Vegetable Literacy of seeds that I want to be on the lookout for throughout the winter. So reading the books, cooking from them, appreciating the diversity and the abundance of what we can grow, but also preparing for our next garden season. We're always looking forward.
All right. Well, I am looking forward to the next time that we speak together. And as always, Venus Williams, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, and happy autumn.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden, and she joins us every month for Dig In, a series all about gardening, herbs, and healthy cooking. You can find some of our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of the conversations today on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. You can also catch this episode again tonight at 8 p.m. Tomorrow on the show, Milwaukee's City Health Commissioner gives an update on the COVID-19 Delta variant and what you need to know about vaccine booster shots. We'll also explore some culturally specific misinformation surrounding COVID-19 and vaccinations. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.